Right? Let me reveal myself more to them. And as he reveals himself more to us, then our consciousness clears. The defects of material nature, which we talked about in the beginning of the class, the imperfect senses, the tendency to cheat, to be illusioned, and so forth, all of those things are because we don't want to know the truth, not the absolute truth. We don't want to know that God is great, because then we can't think that we're great. We can't think that we're the center. So because we don't want to think that God is the center, we become covered. As we hear more about Krishna and as he reveals himself more to us, his revelation to us drives away the covering, just like the sun drives away the fog in the morning. One doesn't make a separate endeavor to get rid of illusion. And as we hear more about him, then we want to hear more about him. We start to relish more and more. Our initial taste, as we say, parindristva nivartate, our initial taste starts increasing and increasing. And as it increases and increases, we want to hear and chant about him more. And as we know more about him, then he gets excited and he reveals himself to us more and more. And it keeps snowballing. It keeps circling. And as that happens, the illusion goes away more and more. And we get direct perception, pratyaksha avagamam dharmam. And so this is how we get to know the absolute truth. It has to start with hearing from the devotees with some faith. It has to start with that. And then it continues to be hearing and chanting from the devotees and with the devotees. And then not only do we get to know the absolute truth in terms of Krishna himself, but we get to know the absolute truth in terms of who we are in our relationship with him. All of that gets revealed simultaneously. So pretty soon our attraction to Krishna becomes not just a general attraction, but a specific attraction that we start, because it is subjective. One starts becoming attracted to the Lord in a particular way. I'm just recently finished reading the chapter about the passing of Bhishma, and how, although he prays to the gopis, his desire is to go to Vaikuntha and see the Lord as his master in a chivalrous mood. That's his particular desire. He knows about the gopis, he knows about Vrindavan, he knows about Rasleela, but that's not his desire. He doesn't want to be a gopi entering into Rasleela. He wants to have a chivalrous mood as in Dasya Ras in Vaikuntha. And each of us awakens our own particular taste of wanting to be with the Lord. And as that taste awakens, our interest in illusion further recedes, we know the Lord more and more. And finally, the illusion is gone, and we are firmly and completely, permanently situated in that relationship. But even in that relationship, our knowledge of the Lord constantly expands. Even materially, psychologists, psychiatrists who study relationships say that unless there's mystery in the relationship, it becomes old. That once you feel, I know this person inside and out, which of course is never true, but once one feels like that, then the relationship becomes boring. That what keeps relationships viable and active is that sense of mystery. And Krishna has a sense of mystery about the jiva also. Krishna is surprised by the activities of the jiva. This is the activity of yogamaya. Krishna is always expanding, and his knowledge is always expanding behind his expansion. And Krishna is always learning something new about the jiva and being surprised and fascinated by the jiva, as the jiva is always being surprised and fascinated by the Lord. Now, Prabhupada also makes the point in this purport that this whole process has to take place, diving prakritim ashutaha, it takes place under the guidance of the internal energy. Just like our illusion takes place under the guidance of Durga, so our awakening takes place under the guidance of the Lord's consort. And we could certainly speak for a long time about this, how the absolute truth, being complete, being purna, is both masculine and feminine. that there's the debate, you know, is God masculine or feminine? And it's interesting that, again, talking about subjectivity, that some people, when they have a realization of truth, they realize it is feminine. One assumes that they must be realizing Durga within this material world. Because as soon as you have the feminine without the masculine, then it becomes Durga. Yeah, she becomes Durga, just like Ravana. But even in the ultimate spiritual world, especially in Goloka Vrindavan, but I'm assuming the same is true in Mathura and Dwarka and Ayodhya and so forth, there are those who favor the feminine. So you have persons like Raghunath Das Goswami, who considers that his chief object of worship is Srimati Radharani, and that he worships Krishna because Krishna is associated with Radharani. Whereas others are worshiping Krishna, and they worship Radharani because she's associated with Krishna. So a lot of our songs and prayers can be understood in either way. Radha, who's the lover of Krishna, or Krishna, who's the lover of Radha, and so forth. And I really like how Srila Prabhupada here lists Lakshmi Devi, Sita Devi, Radharani, or Rukmini Devi. So again, depending on one's personal mood, the manifestation of the internal potency of which one takes shelter will be different. It will be different. It's not that everybody is going to take shelter of Srimati Radharani. It depends on one's personal mood. And indeed, even in Goloka Vrindavan, there are different groups of gopis. So the shastras describe that there's 8 chief gopis. So some people are going to be under the shelter of Bhadra or Shamala and so forth. So ultimately, of course, one can say everyone is under the shelter of Srimati Radharani as the supreme goddess of fortune, just like one could say that ultimately everyone is under the shelter of Krishna. However, again, those in Vaikuntha or those in Ayodhya, they don't see their master exactly as Krishna. Oh, it's the same person. It's the same person. There's only one God, but a different mood. So some people may like the mood of Rukmini Devi. Some people may like the mood of Sita Devi. Some people may like the mood of Lakshmi Devi. Right? They're different. With Sita Devi, she's the only consort of the Lord. And she's in a mood generally of great submission. Lakshmi Devi, she's sharing the Lord, Sri, Bhu, and Nila with 2 other consorts. Rukmini Devi is sharing the Lord with many, many thousands of consorts. Although she's the chief and she has her particular mood, Srimati Radharani, again, is sharing the Lord with many, many billions of consorts, although as she has her particular mood. So as the in a general way, we say at the beginning, worship Radha Krishna, everybody worship Radha Krishna, everybody worship Lakshmi Narayana. But as one matures, one starts taking shelter of some particular mood of the internal energy. And why does one have to take shelter of the internal energy for all this to happen? Why does this whole process of hearing and chanting with affection, clearing one's consciousness, getting direct perception, wanting more and more to hear and chant, getting a personal relationship, knowing the Lord directly, why does this have to take place under the shelter of the internal energy? Because wanting to separate the Lord and his internal energy, one could say, is at the root of our not wanting to see the Lord. Right? I basically want to throw out the Lord and enjoy his internal energy myself. The difference between Hanuman and Ravana. So Ravana wants to kidnap Sita, and he wants to be the Lord of Sita. So if you want the Lord without his internal energy, it means that I want those opulences. What is the internal energy? We're talking about all the opulences. Wealth, fame, beauty, knowledge, renunciation, wisdom, so forth. So I want those things, right? In material consciousness, that's exactly what we want. I want to be the most famous. I want to be the most wealthy. I want to be the most beautiful. I want to be the most intelligent. I want to be the most detached. I want to be the most strong and healthy and so forth. So I want all those opulences. I want to own them. And if I want to know Krishna, then I have to accept that he's the owner of the opulences. That whatever opulences I have are really his. That he's sharing his opulences with me, just like a head of a company shares the company opulences with the employees, just like a government shares their opulences with the citizens, just like parents share their opulences with the children. But the opulences belong to God. So without the shelter of the internal potency without accepting that this internal potency, the feminine potency, the potency of all pleasure, the potency of all opulences, belongs to the Lord, there is no question of properly hearing and chanting about him. Because the demons will also hear and chant about the Lord. Constantly heard and chanted about Krishna. The modern atheists, they hear and chant about religion. It's not that they don't hear and chant about religion. But because they don't do so under the shelter of the internal energy, because they don't relish hearing, oh, they may even relish. They may even, oh, I enjoy talking about Krishna, how we're going to kill him. Though they may relish in that way. But because they don't take shelter of the Lord's internal potency, but want her for themselves, therefore the Lord doesn't reveal himself. I mean, would anybody, right? If somebody comes to your house with the idea of flirting with your wife and taking your wife, you wouldn't exactly invite her into your house. You want someone to respect you with your consort, not separately. So this is also the mood of Krishna. So our main practice, as Srila Prabhupada says, as the Shastras say, as all the Acharyas say, over and over and over again, the main process of bhakti is his Shravanam Kirtanam. That is our main process. That is the essence of the practice. Satatam Kirtayantam, as Krishna himself says. Now that's not the only practice. Yatantas Chaudrida Vritaha Namasyantas Chimam Bhaktya Nitya Yukta Upasate. Krishna's mentioning here taking great vows. Like we take vows, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no meat eating, no gambling. For at this time in Kali Yuga, those are pretty big vows. I mean, after you do them for a long time in Bhakti Yoga, you don't even notice you're doing them anymore. It's something just like breathing. But for most people, they're great vows. I was reading some research that many people who claim to be vegetarian actually eat some meat every day. They find it difficult to be vegetarian. What to speak of the other ones? An Ekadasi vow, and so forth and so on. Namasyantas, offering obeisances, Nichayukta, Upasate, offering worship. So there are certainly other practices. There are 64 angas of bhakti, and any of those angas of bhakti can give one complete perfection. Just taking Charanamrita one time, just seeing the Rath Yatra cart one time, any of those can give complete perfection. None of them are lacking in potency. At the same time, we can say that the most essential activity in bhakti is hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. That is how we get to know someone. That is how we endear ourselves to someone. That is how we reestablish our relationship with someone. And that is how we will know what's absolutely true. We will never know what's absolutely true, absolutely, because even he who is himself what's absolutely true does not absolutely know himself at any time. And our final point here is in the verse we have the word vatsa. Vatsa means calf. And it would be very much equivalent in a modern English slang where we call a child a kid. A kid literally means a baby goat. And if we have some affection for a child, we call them a kid. And we may even call another adult a kid. You know, hey kiddo. Just like people often call their romantic interest a baby, right? Hey, baby. I love you, baby. You know, this sort of affection. So here Maitreya is talking to Vidura. Maitreya is much older than Vidura, although Vidura is pretty old himself at this point. And he calls him Vatsa. There's some affection. So this is the thread that distinguishes the hearing and chanting of the devotees, that awakens love of God and has the Lord reveal himself under the shelter of the internal energy, and the hearing and chanting of the Lord by just a mundane scholar and philosopher, even if they get to that besides their empiricism, that there's affection. There's a sense of affection, there's a sense of pleasure, there's a sense of enjoyment. And if one is ever hearing and chanting about the Lord as some official religious ritual, that is not bhakti yoga. One's not performing bhakti yoga. One's doing something, but it's not bhakti yoga. So bhakti yoga has bhakti. There's some sense of affection between ourself and the Lord, between ourself and the Lord's devotees. And that sense of affection and kindness and consideration just increases and increases and increases until it finally produces the fruit, the sweet fruit of love of God. So questions, comments, etc.
you mentioned something that kind of tantalized me, but then you passed right by it. The six, maybe you didn't want to get bogged down, but you mentioned the six arguments against empiricism.
Okay, if you want me to find that, I got to find it on my computer.
Sounded pretty interesting. We could do it another time if it wasn't that easy accessible.
Well, if I can do it in an easy search on my computer. So far, not. Let's try again. I can't find. I'll look for it while someone's asking something else.
Okay, Mother Irmela, while you're looking that up, this is Dr. Chris. How would you define affection?
Well, the psychologists have tried to define love, and they've defined love as three things: that you find the other person fascinating, that you value the other person; they're important. And that you consider that you have their back and they have your back. You can depend on them. So those are the three ways in which those are the three ways in which love is defined. And I would say affection is a form of love, where it's affection is probably in the fascinating category, that I find you fascinating.
Hare Krishna?
Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I just looked it up in the dictionary. I also studied philosophy in college, and empiricism is the doctrine that all knowledge is derived from sense experience.
Yes.
That's all.
Okay, here we go. Found it. All right, six problems. One is called the do him pay. Okay, way too much noise. One is called the. How are we? What's happening, Ramananda? With all the noise.
Trying to figure out where it's coming from.
Echo.
Anyway, as soon as I can figure it out, I will mute. I've got my pen in hand here.
Okay, we have the Duhem Klein thesis and auxiliary assumptions. That means that you cannot ascribe causation to two things just because there's a correlation. The example's given that when there's a fire, there's fire trucks. However, that doesn't mean that either fire trucks cause fires or fires cause fire trucks. So many times in empiric research, we look for a correlation, what two things go together, but that, again, does not imply causation. There could be a third cause. There could be some other factor that we don't know about. And such is particularly true when we talk about living entities and their behaviors, or human beings and their behaviors. You know, like we know that children whose parents divorce are themselves more likely to divorce. But why? Is it that the parents divorce that causes the children to be more likely to divorce, or is there a third factor that causes both? We don't know. Okay, the next is what's called the problem of induction, that it gives you probable but not absolute results. And this is what Prabhupada brings up all the time, that you've seen everybody's died, but maybe someone hasn't died. Or what I brought up about the black swans. So you can only see a certain number of instances of something. You can only check things a certain number of times. Maybe there's an instance you haven't found. And what's really a problem with this is you don't even know what percentage you have. So, because you don't know what the total number is. So if I don't know what the total number of swans is on the earth, so even if I've seen 10 million swans, I don't know if I've seen 1% of swans or 90% of swans. So if I reach a conclusion based on 10 million swans, I don't know what the probability of my having a correct answer even is. And what to speak of all over the universe? If there are swans on other planets, I don't even know that they exist. So I may be basing my conclusion on only, you know, a tenth of a percent of that phenomenon without any knowledge of it. So I, basically, I don't know what I don't know. And therefore, all I can say is, so far, with all of the items in this class that we've studied, we can reach this conclusion. So far, it's not been true. It's not been shown to be false. You can never say, never, ever in empiricism say, this is true. You can just say, so far, with what we've studied, it's not false. Third is the social nature of research. What we perceive is colored by our current cultural biases. I mean, one example of this is what is the proper age for marriage? What is the age of consent? You know, it wasn't a long time ago that people were getting married at 12 and 13 and 14 years old. Just prior to World War II, people were married in their early to mid-teens. And, of course, in the animal kingdom, the animals mate as soon as they're sexually mature. And that was considered normal and healthy and socially good. It was considered a good thing by society. And now that's considered to be greatly evil. You know, it's just fascinating. For example, breast cancer has increased, I think, 8 times. And all the scientists know that one way that you greatly decrease your chances of breast cancer is to have a baby before you're 20. So that's a well-known medical fact. And yet, people marrying and having children before 20 is considered bad in modern society. So what's considered good, what's considered bad, how you view things, what you consider to be true, is very much colored by the culture at the time. And this is true even for just, you know, fact. Is homosexuality hardwired? Is it a choice? Is it different for different people? And, you know, the research that you'll come to on this is dependent on your social milieu. And you'll see things that way. You'll interpret things according to your social bias. Then the fourth is what's called the relativity of the light of reason. And this is our individual biases. So what's obvious to me is not obvious to you. You know, we'll both be looking at the same set of data, and I'll say, oh, here's an obvious conclusion, and you'll say, that's not an obvious conclusion. I don't see that at all. I mean, it's interesting with my grandchildren here, they had a habit of just saying anything they disagree with, saying that makes no sense. So I'm training them to say, that makes no sense to me. I say, if you say to someone that makes no sense, you're insulting them. But the reality is that what makes complete sense to me may make no sense to you. And this is true even if we're looking at exactly the same data. I mean, I don't know if I should bring this up, but like right now in ISKCON, you know, there's been this ongoing debate about whether or not women can give initiation, whether or not women can be Diksha Gurus. So we'll be looking at the same verses and we'll be looking at the same statements from Srila Prabhupada and reaching opposite conclusions. You know, Prabhupada says, I hope that by, you know, I want all my spiritual sons and daughters to initiate. I hope that by 1975, they will be initiating disciples. So some people look at that and say, oh, Prabhupada obviously wanted both his male and female disciples to become Diksha Gurus. And other people look at it and say, well, he wanted to do that by 1975 and he didn't, so he changed his mind. And obviously he doesn't want them to initiate disciples. So they're looking at the same data and reaching opposite conclusions. Then number five is called theory-laden perception. And this means that our, and this particular fact is something that's really emphasized by a lot of spiritual teachings and what we would have to call New Age philosophies, that it's not that our perceptions create our beliefs exactly, but it's more that our beliefs color our perceptions. So if I believe something to be true, I will see it in that way. And perhaps the greatest evidence of this is the Brunner-Postman anomalous card experiment done in 1949, which I don't have time to explain right now, but you're welcome to look it up. And when you read about that card experiment, you say, oh my God. We see what we expect to see. Another thing, which unfortunately I have to give it away by saying what it is, but it's a video called The Invisible Gorilla. You could always show it to somebody else. And there, very, very much, we see what we expect to see. And if we don't expect to see something, we don't see it. The majority of accidents between cars and motorcycles is because the drivers of the cars don't see the motorcycles. And the reason they don't see the motorcycles is they don't expect to see a motorcycle. We see what we expect to see. We have a preconceived notion of what's to be expected. And something can be right in front of us, but if it's not what we expect to see, we literally, very literally, do not see it. We just don't see it at all. I mean, there's been so many experiments done like this that we just don't perceive it. We'll say, it's not there. It's there. Can't you see? No, it's not there. And no matter how much somebody says that it's there, we will not see it. The sixth one is underdetermination of theory by evidence. And this is that evidence or data never suggests only one explanation. So the reality of this is obvious in a crime. That when there's a crime committed, there's evidence. But the evidence can have more than one story about it. There's so many instances of, you know, the detectives, etc. They see the evidence, oh, this is what happened, this is the story, and then they're wrong. And sometimes 20 years later, they're wrong, and they find out the wrong person has been put in prison unjustly, etc., etc. And all of the detective books and movies hinge on this fact of empiricism, that the evidence, even if we're all seeing the evidence the same way, even putting aside cultural bias, even putting aside individual bias, even putting aside the fact that I'm seeing what I expect to see, even putting all that aside, even if we all see exactly the same thing in exactly the same way, we can still create 1,000 different stories to explain the evidence. So these are the 6 problems with empiricism or positivism.
Interesting. Thank you.
And what's most interesting is that these problems are admitted by the empiricists. So the empiricists themselves, they say our process is flawed because. And therefore, because of those 6 things, empiricism will never yield truth. No matter how many scientists replicate it, it will not yield truth. You know, another interesting aside on this is someone will say, well, but empiric science has given us so many wonderful things. So if empiric science doesn't tell us how nature works, then, you know, how is it created penicillin and cars and airplanes and things like that? And when I was growing up, the main argument in favor of empiric science was that empiric science has improved the world, and has improved the world by discovering the laws of nature. Now, if we think about this a little bit, we'll see it's true that through empiric science, one can understand to some extent how nature works, so as to be able to manipulate nature in many wonderful ways. I mean, I have this little gadget that fits in my hand, and with this gadget that fits in my hand, I can have a video phone conversation with somebody on the other end of the globe practically instantaneously. Wow, they must understand something about truth. But what is the result of this little gadget that I can carry around with me? The result of this gadget is so much suffering of so many people in other countries who are working with toxic chemicals and getting so many diseases, and their rivers are becoming, in Bangalore, the river or the lake is so polluted. It's full of all this foam that lights on fire. So somebody's not understanding the laws of material nature. Are they really improving life on the planet? Do they really understand how nature works? You know, if I feed you something delicious that tastes really good and gives you cancer, have I really understood how your body works? As Prahlad says, the cures are worse than the diseases. So, yeah, they've cured one thing or another. And, you know, I have all this instant communication with people, and I can do all kinds of things that I couldn't do before. But now I've got to spend 2 to 4 hours a day on correspondence, whereas, you know, 15 years ago, I only spent 2 hours a week on correspondence. So do they really understand? Are they really getting closer to truth? Does all their empiricism, are they really getting people healthier? So they can do microsurgery through a robot thousands of miles away. You can have a doctor in Perth, Australia, do surgery on someone in Wichita, Kansas, through a remotely operated robot arm. Well, they must know, they must be understanding about chemistry, physics, mathematics, biology. But are people getting healthier? What's the net, what's the overall result of what they're doing? The overall result is they're poisoning the planet. They're destroying the diversity of species. They're ruining the lives of huge numbers of people to serve small numbers of people. I mean, the overall result is much worse. At least it isn't any better. So I don't think they're really understanding nature at all. I don't think their empiricism has gotten them an understanding of how the material nature works, or they wouldn't be causing a worse problem, far worse problem, than the one that they set out to solve. Does that make sense?
That's great. That helps a lot. This is kind of like another version of our four defects.
Yes. Yes. Well, they admit the four defects too. That's why I was saying it's, you really have to put the whole thing together. Because when you're studying the philosophy of science, they talk about the four defects in much more depth even than we do as devotees. That, as I was saying earlier, that we don't even know that we're perceiving what we're perceiving. I don't, I'm looking at a tree out my window, but I don't actually know for sure that that tree exists and that my perception of the tree is real at all. I actually don't know that.
Then we get in solipsism.
Yes. I mean, I really don't know that. And even if everybody, if every human being on the planet were to come here and look at the same tree and say, yes, that's a tree, that doesn't give me any assurance that that tree actually exists. And then I'm actually perceiving it. So they get to that level of uncertainty. What to speak of who is the perceiver? They haven't a clue as to who's doing the perception. So is there actually a sense object there? How is it being perceived? And who is perceiving it? They don't know. For practical purposes of working in the world, they accept that we're perceiving a real tree. But when it comes down to their philosophy, they don't really know whether or not we're perceiving the real truth. They don't know that. They can't say that with certainty at all. So, of course, this is the realm of Sankhya, which is very much the subject of the second and third canto, the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, chapters 13 through 18 of the Bhagavad Gita, is dealing with these sorts of questions. Who am I? What is my relationship to the body? What is the mind? What are the sense objects? What are they made out of? Even this whole section on the universal form. What are sense objects actually? And, they're not what we think they are. They're not. That is not really a tree. A real tree is in Goloka Vrindavan. This is not a real tree. It's a very temporary reflection or semblance of a tree, which is combined by the modes of material nature as a fleeting, flash of an experience for that jiva and me. And it's, that's what's really happening. And then how we perceive this, a lot of discussion in the Bhagavatam about how we're perceiving, how it's really the universal form and the demigods controlling the sense objects and how the senses interact with their sense objects and the mind and how I'm just the observer and so forth. But through mental speculation, the main conclusion that they come to is, gosh, we're totally lost. We're blind, we're deaf, we're lost, we haven't the foggiest notion of who we are, we don't know what we're perceiving, we don't even know if we're perceiving. We all of our instruments, all of our methods are grossly defective and wrong. All the conclusions that we come to are wrong. You know, we have no assurance whatsoever that we're giving you anything that remotely is true. What to speak of being absolutely true, we don't even know if it's relatively true. We don't know anything at all. Oh, but you should follow us because we're the authorities and we're going to make the world a better place. And go, what?
Mataji?
Yes.
Amazing class. You really need to focus, concentrate. It's really good. Anyway, I just wanted to share with you that Gopi Parandan Prabhu, in his lecture series on Upanishads, he's discussed this at great length, and a person has to have real patience to go through that, you know?
Yes.
Because who has the patience? So what Srila Prabhupada has given us has completely, you know, what do you call it, given us the essence, so we don't have to go through that arduous process.
Yes.
But it's all there. Gopi Parandan Prabhu has given, there are those tapes, you know, on Upanishads, on Upanishads.
Yes, yes.
Oh. And exactly what you are talking now.
Yes, yes. He was a good friend of our family, Gopi Prandana, who he's very much missed. But people like Gopi Prandana, Suhota Swami, Sarputra Prabhu, they really explained these aspects of the philosophy. But it's so wonderful. In bhakti, we don't need to have some sort of big intellectual brain. All we need to do is hear and chant about Krishna with affection in the association of devotees. That's all we need to do. And even a little child.
But there is this need, you know, the Shamika Prabhu here from Oxford branch of Hinduism branch, Oxford University.
Uh-huh.
My God, he was lamenting. He's saying that some scholars need to study all this stuff because they are discrediting, you know, they are at some level discrediting our, Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta completely. So we do need scholars.
Absolutely.
To defend. So that's why, luckily, I have all this information. He was like really lamenting. He says, where are the people? We really need to defend, because we had people like Baldev Vidyabhushanam in the past. Yes. Alone, he stayed up all night to write this, you know.
You're driving the buses. So become a great scholar, or find some. Actually, more and more devotees are becoming well known in the scholarly fields. So it's happening more and more. We have our Arjuna Karma Prabhu, certainly, and we have a whole crew of scientists from Manipur and so forth. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.